From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for April Bear. There are just a handful of truly competitive state house races this year in Michigan. But if Democrats can flip enough of them, there is a chance we'd end up with a very rare split right down the middle.
This has sort of been like Bigfoot for the last 28 years. People sort of talk about seeing it or possibly seeing it, and it never actually happens.
We'll ask, what would that even look like? And then a Detroit native on his Pulitzer-winning meta musical.
I was never censoring or editing myself with how much I would say the unsayable.
And how one family is keeping their small town newspaper going in the digital age.
So many smaller newspapers get bought up by larger conglomerates, and then the writers of those newspapers don't even live in the area.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in today for April Bear. On the show, as local newspapers continue to decline and close, one Michigan family has kept the Minden City Herald running for nearly eight decades.
So we've had it, we're just finishing our last issue as we're speaking right now, and it'll be number 1,998 consecutive weeks.
And now a new generation is taking the reins. We will have that conversation coming up. But first, 110 seats are up for election come November in Michigan's State House. 110. Divide that by two parties and you have got the possibility of a 55-55 split. This is what Zach Gorchow, executive editor and publisher of Gongward News Service, has been thinking about. Hey, Zach.
Hello, Zoe.
Okay, so this idea of a split Republican-Democratic legislature without a Democratic or Republican majority, it has happened before, almost some two decades ago, in a time known in Lansing as shared power. Is it really possible that we could see this again this November?
Sure, yes, it is possible. I think just the way you have a current majority, Republicans, essentially 58-52, so a Democratic gain of three seats would produce a 55-55 tie. And there's so few seats that are legitimately competitive this cycle that you can pretty easily see right now a path for the Democrats to get to 55. And getting to more than that looks challenging. So it's certainly on people's minds. You talk to people watching this, who watch the House closely, they say this really could happen. Now, this has sort of been like Bigfoot for the last 28 years. People sort of talk about seeing it or possibly seeing it, and it never actually happens. But it has happened twice since Michigan went to 110-seat House about 60 to 70 years ago. Once in the 60s, although if my history is correct, I believe one of the members actually voted to caucus with the other side, so there was no shared power. But then the one that everybody remembers who was around then is the 1993-94 term, when it was 55-55, and you did have co-speakers of the House.
And quickly, what did that look like for folks who are saying, oh my gosh, could this happen? I mean, co-speakers, is there really no one party in charge? What would that actually look like in today's politics in Lansing?
So you also had committees that were evenly split and with co-committee chairs. But the way they did it was the party with the gavel rotated. So you would have, say, the Republican co-speaker would be up at the speaker's chair 1 month, and then the Democratic co-speaker would go the next month. So that allowed the, you know, one part or the other to control the agenda and choose which bills would come up for a vote. But of course, nothing could move or actually or pass without some amount of bipartisan support, even if that was only one vote from the other side. That's what it would look like. You wouldn't have total paralysis in terms of the agenda. But you can't get anything to pass if you don't have a majority of members elected and serving, which would mean as long as it was still 55-55, you'd need at least one vote from the other side.
And for many political dorks, I mean, I do own the book Sharing the Balance of Power. There is actually a book about it, highly suggested if folks are interested in reading a little bit more about the history. But coming back to 2020, you mentioned that there really are few truly toss-up seats. Which ones are you keeping an eye on that we should keep an eye on then?
Well, so I mentioned three that were more likely to flip. So let's deal with those first. You have a seat in Novi and South Lyon Township. I think that one is a slight favorite to go to the Democrats, open seat with no incumbent. You have a seat in the Western Kalamazoo suburbs, think like Portage, also an open seat with no incumbent. Democrats, I think, are slight favorites there as well. And then you have a seat in West Bloomfield, Commerce Township, and Wixom, I believe, where you have a Republican incumbent, Ryan Berman, but with the trends that are going on in Oakland County, I think that's seen as maybe a slight favorite to the Dems as well, though not to the extent of the first two. So you have those three right there. Where mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, these aren't locked up, I don't think, for the Democrats. They got to win them first. These are areas that two of them have never elected Democrats to those seats. So I'm always kind of skeptical it'll happen until it happens. But I think by and large, the dynamics favor them. Then I think the next two, which are the ones that are going to determine, you know, if the Democrats can win the majority or not, is a seat in Rochester Hills, and a little bit of Oakland Township in Northeast Oakland County. You can see a pattern here. There's a lot of Oakland County going on. It's all suburban areas we're talking about.
Yeah.
And then the last one is the exact borders of Grand Traverse County. So Traverse City and Environs, another open seat. This one, I think, is a real wild card. The Democrats have a very good candidate who, in Dan O'Neill, an attorney raising lots of money, came within a whisker of ousting the Republican incumbent 2 years ago. Candidate to candidate, I think the Democrats have an advantage, but the dynamics of this district still, I think, favor the Republicans. President Trump won the seat by 10 points. I don't think he's going to win it by as much this time, but he's also not going to get crushed. There's a lot of those lower propensity Trump voters in this Grand Traverse County seat that didn't show up in 2018 who are quite likely to come back to the mm-hmm. polls in 2020. And probably makes it a harder flip for the Democrats this time. And certainly the primary turnout, there wasn't a lot of activity on the Republican side, but the primary turnout was not as promising for Democrats this time as it was in 2018.
Okay, that is Zach Gorchow, executive editor and publisher of Gongwer News Service here in Michigan. He has been dreaming, daydreaming, thinking about another shared power situation in Lansing. Zach, we are going to keep an eye on these races along with you through November.
Thanks for having me, Zoe.
Days. That is how long we have until the November election, an election that we know Michigan is a top prize for both parties, and they are fighting hard to win it. So next Tuesday, 1A host Jen White will be taking over stateside to talk about the state's battleground status. And of course, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the role our state will play in this November's election? Send us your thoughts. We're at stateside@michiganradio.org, or leave us a voicemail. Call 734-764-7840. Again, that's 734-764-7840. You can also find us on Twitter. Tweet us. We're at Stateside Radio. And then be sure to listen to the 1A takeover of Stateside with Jen White next Tuesday. A paper. paper company that's part of the Superfund cleanup of the Kalamazoo River says it's worried about silt from a dam upstream. Georgia-Pacific wants to know if PCBs have washed out of Morrow Lake in Comstock. The company says it can find out by testing fish. But as WMUK's Sevilla Mann reports, the state has a problem with that.
The company that owns Morrow Dam near Galesburg lowered Morrow Lake last year. That's allowed a huge amount of silt to wash downriver into the Superfund site where Georgia-Pacific is one company cleaning up toxic chemicals known as PCBs.
I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that more PCBs have come down the river.
Rick Kimball is a spokesman for Georgia Pacific. He says the cleanups cost more than $120 million so far, with more dredging set for this fall. The company wants to compare PCB levels in smallmouth bass above the dam with smallmouth bass downstream. These would be little fish hatched this year. Kimball says a young fish gives a better idea of what kind of pollution is nearby.
Whereas if you sample a three-year-old fish, for example, you've got a three-year-old fish that has traveled different parts of the river, picked up different things, and it's not a very good indicator.
Georgia Pacific has asked Michigan's Department of Natural Resources for permission to sample smallmouth bass. Matt Diana is a fish biologist with the DNR. He says the agency will probably turn the company down. Diana says the sediment from the lake likely killed off many smallmouth bass eggs this year.
You're not getting the kind of spawning you normally would. Populations are likely going to be depressed because of that. So, you know, we're really concerned about that population.
Diana says the PCB cleanup does call for periodic smallmouth bass testing, though not this year. Diana says, unfortunately, that sampling has shown a lot of variation from fish to fish.
And it makes it really tough to go out and sample from one event like a Morrow drawdown and say, yes, we're seeing changes based on that.
Georgia Pacific says it could restock the river with smallmouth bass, but Diana says that would amount to fixing what's not broken, at least not yet. He says the company could sample the water or sediment instead. The DNR is expected to decide on the permit in the next few days. I'm Sevilla Mann.
Detroit native Michael R. Jackson was awarded the Pulitzer Prize this year for his off-Broadway musical, A Strange Loop. Jackson's show is a musical about a character writing a musical. It is the first musical to win the Pulitzer without making it to Broadway. Jackson recently spoke with April Baer.
Michael R. Jackson is a graduate of Cass Technical High School in Detroit. And he joins us now. Michael, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It is so crushing to have learned this news that you won the Pulitzer for a play that so many Americans will not have a chance to see for a while. What has this been like for you?
I keep saying this like in interviews that I do. I feel like I'm Samuel Beckett from Quantum Leap. I keep like going from dimension to dimension, trying to get back home. And it's like every day is like a new sort of adventure. I'm in this pandemic mode one moment in the world and craziness and the darkness of that. And then like I get like this great news about this award. And then that takes me sort of emotionally into like a different space. And that's really exciting. And it's just like that constant traveling back and forth. But it's been great.
The show A Strange Loop comes out of the gate reminding us that as much as queer history is tied up in Broadway, there are certain kinds of queerness, black queerness, for example, that have not had the same treatment. And then the show proceeds to give us a narrative that imagines what that might look like in the persona of a young queer black man with the, I guess, utterly bankable name of Disney Usher. that's kind of a genius moniker for what you're doing here, and it seems like the kind of references that have been important to you.
Yeah, you know, this piece is, I don't think of it as autobiographical as much as self-referential.
Yeah.
Early on, I sort of decided that I needed to give myself some distance from being like, this is a story about my life, because I knew that it wasn't totally that. It was like a perception of life. As a younger person, there was a lot I was trying to figure out. It wasn't until I was much older that I had some distance from like sort of the struggles of my youth. Once I had that objectivity, it was like, this character is not Michael, but it's like a perception of Michael. And that perception of Michael is another person who has a famous name.
Usher has a job that goes right along with his name as well. So people are always yelling at him, Usher.
Right, exactly.
And he's a different kind of protagonist than a lot of theater goers have seen before. Could you tell us a little bit about the actor who originated the role, Larry Owens?
The actor who originated the role was Larry Owens, who was someone who I met through the Musical Theater Factory, which is a musical theater development hub here in New York City. And he sort of like raised his hand for the part at a point when I was still figuring out what it was. I kind of can't talk totally about him without talking about like the entire cast, just because it's 7 principals are in the piece, and they sort of all inform the sort of tone and the sonic world of it. And so he was just sort of one of many colors in sort of trying to tell this story about selfhood and Black queer selfhood.
The other cast members that you say are sort of a Greek chorus playing many roles that reflect interior monologues for Usher, as well as other real life characters that you need them to portray.
Yeah, the other characters are Usher's thoughts. And so though Usher is the protagonist of the show, his thoughts, they're mirroring back on him, and he's mirroring back on the thoughts, which is why I it's always important to me to stress that the show is in fact about these sort of 7 Black queer bodies on stage. And they are there to like express like his deepest sort of desires and self-hatred and his humor, his critique of, you know, culture, of Black culture, of white theater culture, of like, it's just every sort of thought that makes up who he is as a person. They sort of make up all of that, and all those things make up him.
There's a lyric in one of the songs called Today, and it goes, "I hate days like today, days when I face myself, but see the same reflection, someone who's stuck rewriting and stuck in his own way, someone who has to edit every imperfection." Could you talk a little bit about the tension between the joys of reinventing oneself and the feeling that we may not be sure if we want to change ourselves in ways that might smooth over our rough spots?
If I talk about my own experience, as a young person, I was just like so convinced every day was like such a struggle and a challenge to feel like I belonged in the world. And so I would always give myself these little challenges to like see if I could somehow win the day. And inevitably I would fail, you know, because like I was always setting myself up for these like incredibly high bars. And the reason why I was doing that all came from the same place, is that I felt that I wasn't enough. And that something was wrong with me that needed to be fixed. And this idea, I think, that something is wrong with you is something that probably a lot of people can relate to on some level, even if they don't name it. Because, like, there's all these things that you do in your life that are you sort of betraying your own integrity or your own boundaries just because you think that if you do it, that it's going to prove something greater about yourself. And so Usher had to get to a place in the piece of realizing that nothing was wrong with him. And in that moment is when he actually does change.
When you were coming up in Detroit, you were really involved in the Inside Out Literary Arts program. Could you talk a little bit about how that shaped the direction of your writing?
Yeah, it was really important because I was a student at Cass Tech in Detroit. And my creative writing teacher, Ms. Thompson, immediately, you know, brought in Inside Out into our school, and we got to work with writers in residence. And I kept creative writing as my elective for all 4 years of high school. And so I got to work with like all these writers in residence, one of which was this guy named Peter Marcus. And he really challenged me to push the boundaries of what I was writing about, because up until that point, I was kind of like trying to copy Maya Angelou. And I love Maya Angelou, but like I had a lot that was going on inside of me. I was like coming to terms with the fact that I was gay. And like a lot of that writing sort of germinated in Pete's class as a result of Inside Out. and Inside Out also let me see all these writers writing professionally. And I think it was the thing that, like, in addition to talking to my creative writing teacher and saying to her, like, do you think it's a pie in the sky idea to want to be a writer professionally? And she said, no, that like was just what I needed to hear as like an impressionable teenager to decide that I was going to pursue writing professionally in some way.
The musical is so inventive and has some experimental elements to it. Is there a through line from the way you started thinking about creative writing at that time to the form that we now see in this Pulitzer winning play?
Well, I think definitely in terms of content in one way, because like I started writing this piece as a monologue initially. I didn't think it was going to become a musical. I was about 21 years old and I was about to graduate from college and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life with a playwriting degree. And I was writing a lot about what it felt like to be a young Black gay man who thought life was terrible. And in many ways that mindset was reflecting back on when I was like a teenager and sort of also struggling internally with like how to be in the world. The music of it evolved in lots of different ways because I didn't know that it was going to become a musical. So like a lot of the music comes from, you know, I grew up playing at church for choirs. I like had a deep obsession with Tori Amos's music that I do to this day. Like I took those influences. I took the sort of gospel music influences that, you know, I grew up with, the Motown, the Philadelphia sound, like all that 70s sort of soul music that's in there. Like, and then I went and studied musical theater at NYU's graduate musical theater writing program. All those elements, because this show is about this protagonist sort of writing himself into existence, everything that was influencing me was also influencing him and his creations and my creations.
What does it mean to have this musical, which is so centered around insecurities and feelings of being an outsider, to see that narrative win a Pulitzer?
It confirms that what I sort of had been doing all along was the right thing to do, because I never thought that this musical would ever be produced. And then it was. But in the gap when I thought it wasn't going to be produced, I just was like, well, since it'll never be produced, I can just write it however I want. I can be as honest, I can be as daring, I can be as truthful, and I should be as possible. And that sort of integrity, I think, really served the piece because I was never censoring or editing myself with how much I would say the unsayable. And so I felt like when I got the Pulitzer, like the culture had responded to just the truthfulness of the piece, which I think all theater should celebrate anyway, like truthfulness, just like being honest.
Yeah.
Not trying to like appeal to the masses or to be cute, you know, like to just say what you mean what you say. And like A Strange Loop is very much a say what you mean what you say piece.
And let the world make of it what it will.
Yes, and you don't have to like it. And that's something that like is, you know, a really important thing for me. I don't think that everyone has to like everything.
Right.
And you should have a choice to like come to it on your own terms and meet it wherever you are. You know, and that was very much how we approach the production as well, because like some might have thought, oh, this is like this very Black queer piece, and so you have to kind of try to make it appeal to that audience. But I sort of realized, you know, getting ready for the production is like, no, there's something for everyone to learn about this Black queer person, and yet that specificity contains universality. And I wanted to invite the audience to lean in and to care about what was happening.
You make no bones in the play about your own dislike for Tyler Perry's work. And it's funny to hear you say that you also did not want to write something that was written to be acceptable to an audience in the way that Tyler Perry writes to a certain audience. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Well, yeah, and it's like really funny because he actually called me
the other day. No, he did not. Really?
he really did.
What was that conversation like?
It was a short but respectful, short and respectful conversation. He said that he was going to beat my but that he also congratulated me on winning the Pulitzer. And like, and he like wanted to know about the historical nature of the win and like, you know, it was short and sweet. I encouraged him to buy the cast album, which he did, because he had not seen the show. He only had heard about it. And I just have to be like really clear about this. Because in the show, Usher has a distaste for Tyler Perry's work for various reasons.
In no small part because his parents love Tyler Perry and don't understand why he can't write a show like Tyler Perry's shows.
Right. But like the thing of it is that like the issue with Tyler Perry's work is more to do with the actual content and craft of it. And Usher and I are people who care deeply about how things are made. And it's not just that like, oh, this is something that's popular and makes a lot of money, so therefore it must be good. And that's something that I think is like a very pervasive idea in our culture that I find very bothersome and loathsome. I'm not one of those people who like is so high-minded and bougie about who he's writing for or like, or the fact that he writes broad comedies or anything of that nature. It's just that like, I feel like it just needs to be done well. And it needs to make sense.
Did your heart just, like, go through the floor when you realized that he was calling you?
Not exactly. Just because since, you know, this piece got produced, it was almost like the piece became magnetized. And all these sort of people who I had idolized or loved from afar or whatever sort of came to it. So when he called me, it just felt like this is the moment when, like, after all these years of this song Tyler Perry writes for life existing in this musical, finally he hears about it. Because all during the show, when I would do talkbacks, people would be like, does Tyler Perry know about this? Does Tyler Perry know about this? Have you heard from him? Blah, 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 blah. Are you scared? Blah, blah. And I was like, no, I'm not scared. I mean, I have a critique and I'm like making it. And like, and that should be fine. Like the fact that I even have a critique, I think, says that his work is of some importance.
Yeah.
And the truth of it is, like, the song Tyler Perry writes for life is literally about Usher saying to his agent, ew, I don't like Tyler Perry's work and I don't want to write for him. And then the ancestors rising up out of their graves to admonish Usher and say that he's an idiot.
All these icons of black culture.
Yeah, like Harriet Tubman and Whitney Houston and all these people rise up out of their graves to be like, are you insane? And like, who do you think you are to thumb your nose at this important black man who is writing these stories for black people? So like, in a weird way, the song actually honors him, though the satire of it makes it clear what Usher's perspective is.
You know, I could go on with you for hours. The play is amazing. I did want to ask, both your parents still live in Detroit and you're in mm-hmm. New York. And I just wanted to sort of check in and see what it's like for your family navigating this moment right now. Both cities have been hit so hard by the virus.
Yeah. So, I mean, luckily, my family has been very safe. I did have two relatives who were affected by COVID, but they're both now recovered and fine. My parents are, you know, in the house I grew up in. And I, you know, I'm in New York. I know a lot of people here in New York who have gotten sick, but again, thankfully they've all recovered or on their way to recovery. And so my little world so far is okay. My parents are on cloud nine about the Pulitzer and about the show. They saw it and they loved it. It's been really exciting to watch the joy that they get out of this.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in the theatrical community have sort of been celebrating my win as their win. And I truly just, I love that. That to me is one other layer to this that makes this whole experience like more bearable.
Well, Michael R. Jackson, thank you so much for talking with us and congratulations. We can't wait for the time when this can be produced more widely and we can see even more of your work.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
Michael R. Jackson is the author of A Strange Loop, which took a Pulitzer this year for achievement in drama.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in today for April Bear. After decades of running the Minden City Herald, close to the tip of Michigan's thumb, Paul Engel has just handed the reins of his business to his grandson, Nathan Marks. While they come from entirely different media generations, both Nathan and Paul believe local stories can and should strengthen small communities. That is because the paper has been in operation since 1889. The pair spoke with April Bear late last month, just as Paul was putting his final issue of the paper to bed.
Paul Engel and Nathan Marks, welcome both of you to Stateside. We're glad to have you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you having us.
Paul Engel, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, for starters, about how your family got into the newspaper business in the first place.
Oh, it goes back quite a ways. My father was actually a paper boy for the Romeo Observer back in the 1940s. And eventually he became a printer for the Romeo Observer. And then he moved up into the Thumb area. And he worked for the Deckerville Recorder, another small town newspaper, for a while. And then he had an opportunity to buy the Minden City Herald, and he did in 1946.
Wow. Nathan, what do you remember about the paper in the years when you were growing up?
Well, I remember coming to visit them at the shop and being very intimidated by the large printing machines, and being very excited as a child when they would put our names in the newspaper, whether it was for a birthday or because of a visit. And they let me be involved. I remember when I was probably 11 or 12, I got to type up some of the obituaries for the paper. And I just thought that that was the coolest thing to see.
Wow. As a young person writing the obits, what kinds of details did you pick up from that?
I remember just trying to be very precise. I knew that obituaries were important, and it was important not to make any mistakes. And so I'm a pretty fast typer, but I remember trying to be slow and take my time to make sure that I didn't leave anything out or misspell any names or do anything else of that sort. So I knew from then that what they did was very particular work, and you needed to, work hard to make sure that you're doing everything in a manner that is, well, respectful for the person in the obituary, but for all the news that they did. You just have to do things in a certain way that benefits the community and is professional and like just pretty particular. And I remember that about it.
Getting it right. Paul, could you describe for us the Minden City Herald in its current incarnation, sort of what you consider the mission, what kinds of stories you felt have been important to publish?
Well, it's just local news. The bigger newspapers in the area, they'll sit at the courthouse and try to dig up dirt on everybody. But I wouldn't call us a good news newspaper, but we are kind of an area paper that just specializes in local news. And it's been very successful for us. And sometimes you have to kind of ride the fence a little bit, about how some people think and other people think, but it's been successful for us. It's a lot of hard work, but
mm-hmm. What's something that might be typical on the front page?
If something happens, like a fire, let's say, or business people are moving on to do something different, or school news, a lot of school news, anything like that.
Paul, since you did take over the helm of the newspaper in the 1980s, the business has, to say the least, been through some dramatic changes. Have things changed for the Minden City Herald? Are there ways that it looks different today than it did in the 80s?
A lot more color in it.
Right.
Back when we bought the newspaper, we actually printed two pages at a time on an old flatbed press here. And eventually we sent it to a printer to have it done on a web press. Before that, it was a cut and paste operation. Now everything's done electronically for the last 10 years or so. So it gives us a lot more flexibility for color and for colored ads and colored pictures. And it's everything's changed, that's for sure.
Sure. So how
to roll with the flow.
How did you come to this generational transition, Paul, where you're now about to hand the paper off to Nathan?
Well, I'm 69. My wife is 68. Janice and I bought the place on March 1st in 1982. So we've had it, we're just finishing our last issue as we're speaking right now, and it'll be number 1,998 consecutive weeks. And, you know, I knew a couple years ago already that it was getting time, because the technology is just crazy anymore. And Nathan and Amber, they're going to do a lot of different things than what we did.
Nathan, that's your wife. That's your wife, Amber, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's correct.
So, Nathan, your background, I think, is in social work, not journalism. Why did you decide to take this on?
Well, I've been very into family heritage and family history for a long time. And I've always kind of been able to brag to people in passing here and there, you know, just in conversation, thinking how cool it was that my grandparents owned a newspaper and you know, that was in our family. And I knew that grandpa had been trying to sell the paper and had a little bit of tepid interest, but not anything solid. And he brought it up a couple times in passing over the years, but then we all went on vacation around Thanksgiving this last year, and we really got to talk about it a lot more in depth. And I proposed it to my wife, and she was extremely enthusiastic about the idea of it and being able to continue a family legacy and be involved in something so important. We immediately acknowledged the importance of a newspaper to a small community like this, and we felt it would be really meaningful to be a part of something like that.
Paul, when Nathan first expressed interest in this, did you try to warn him off?
We tried to tell him everything that could go wrong that could go wrong. and the biggest thing is it's a life change. You no longer basically get a weekly paycheck. You know, you're going to be the face of the area. You know, so you're going to be going a lot of places. My kids used to complain to me that I would go to the school and always take a camera with me. Well, he's going to be doing that stuff now. But it's very rewarding. You know, my dad told me years ago when we bought the place that you're never going to make much money doing this, but you'll make a good living. And that's kind of what I'm passing on to Nathan and Amber.
Yeah. One of the biggest questions for all news outlets, but especially for print journalism, is how you work out the financials as advertisers have shifted away from print ads. Paul, I wanted to ask how you have made it work in your time, and maybe Nathan, what some of your thoughts are going into the paper's next incarnation. Paul, do you want to start?
Ever since we bought the place, I always spent one day a week, usually Monday, and I go on the road and I call on all our advertisers, our bigger advertisers, of course, and I keep in contact with all of them. Honestly, you know, like during this pandemic, we only had a couple of ads that fell out for a while, but other people hung in there even though their business really suffered, but they stuck with us. And you know, it's just your personal relationship with these people that make it work.
Nathan, have you given any thought to if there is anything that you would change, or are you just going to try to maintain those relationships going forward?
I don't know that we're going to do a lot of changing, maintaining a lot of what my grandparents have done, a lot of the groundwork that they've laid, and they've made so many great connections. And my wife, she up to now was working for the Adrian Symphony Orchestra in Adrian, and she got a lot of experience in talking to advertisers and designing ads, and she's very good at both of those. And we've realized very quickly that the whole community around here, which this newspaper covers a 7 or 8 town region up here, and everyone is very adamant that they want to keep the paper alive. They want to keep it going. And so while I know that a lot of places around the country and around the world have veered away from the print advertising, this area has maintained that. And it not only is reflected in the news advertisements in our paper, but in the other papers that are in this area. There are still dozens or really hundreds of businesses in the Thumb area that are still happy to support print media and to keep this paper going.
My guests today, if you're just joining us, are Nathan Marks, who is assuming control of the Minden City Herald in Sanilac County, taking the handoff from our other guest, his grandfather, Paul Engel. Nathan, do you have any plans to move the Minden City Herald into the digital sphere?
Not to the extent that a lot of newspapers have. So my grandparents haven't had much of a digital thumbprint at all. We were able to buy the domain name for MindenCityHerald.com without any issues. And they don't have a social media. So my wife has set up a Facebook page and an Instagram page. And right now, if you Google Minden City Herald, there's not even a Google business listing. So we have to get that set up. It's kind of nice actually having a blank slate rather than having to take over a ton of different social media and online accounts from my grandparents. We kind of just get to start it from scratch. And in that regard, it's been pretty seamless. And so we're not planning to put a lot of local news out there in article form. We'll have a website that will be a way for people to subscribe and to reach out to us and to access. We're in the process of setting up a digital archives through newspapers.com. They're going to digitize all of the microfilm that goes back to the 1890s, and then that will be available to our subscribers and to others who are interested. But as far as, you know, we're not going to be posting news articles that are in the paper on our website on a weekly basis. It'll be more of a means for us to connect with the community, and especially to connect with a younger generation, with a generation more like mine and my wife. You know, we've raised some eyebrows being millennials taking over a newspaper in 2020. We want to reach those in our age group, and I think using social media is going to be an effective means for that.
Paul, what would you say for you and your wife has been the most meaningful part of running the newspaper over the years?
Oh gosh, you know, just all the relationships that we've grown over the years. You know, it's just like everything's like a big family. And my wife Janice, she does all the Photoshop work with pictures and so forth. And like Nathan said early in the interview here about Obit page. Well, my wife does the Obit pictures, and she makes them just perfect. You look at the other newspapers around, and their pictures usually look pretty terrible. But this is something really meaningful to the family that we want to make it the best, you know, it can be. But it's not a, you know, it's just a small town. We only have 300 people in this town, but we're in the middle of 3 county seats, so you know, we reach out quite a little ways, and it's just a great place for kids to grow up.
Nathan, what do you feel must be retained as you and your wife, Amber, take the paper into its next incarnation?
I think it's important to keep a spotlight on all the things happening in this small community, to keep the community tied together in that respect. Right now, obviously, with COVID happening, a lot of things have been canceled or postponed. But in general, there are a lot of really great community events around here that really brings a community together in ways that you don't really see as much in large cities. I lived in Tulsa for 4.5 years. And while there were always things going on and things to do, it didn't quite have the same feel as a community-oriented and community-centered events that they have in this area. So we want to shine a spotlight on that. And we want to keep this paper for the community. You know, we're not going to delve into national news. There'll be limited, even statewide news. You know, if we're going to write material for the paper, it's going to be about, you know, this region. It's going to be about things that matter to people here. And we just want to maintain that focus on the area here. So many smaller newspapers get bought up by larger conglomerates. And then the writers of those newspapers don't even live in the area anymore. And don't focus heavily on local issues. And we want to do the opposite. We want to ingrain ourselves in the community. We want to invest in the community resources and keep it going as strongly as possible.
I'm sure you both could name numerous examples of that very thing happening, of newspapers in Michigan or other places folding up. What would you say is lost in the communities that lose their local paper?
Oh, gosh. You know, they just lose their identity. There were, let's see, there's probably 3 newspapers in the area here. There were weekly newspapers that were bought up by a larger company. And after just a short period of time, they just closed them up, just wrapped it all into one newspaper. And, you know, the communities all lose their identity. And to me, it's not a good thing. That's for sure. So,
yeah.
My experience has been the same. As I've told people in my life about this venture, I've heard numerous, you know, personal anecdotes about, oh, I had the most wonderful local paper growing up and now it's gone, or it's still there and it's nothing like it used to be. I've heard so many complaints about, you know, all the writers for our local paper, none of them even live in this county. They all live in the closest major city. And you know, they'll drive up here to take some pictures and then drive back home, but they don't feel like they're part of the community. And I do feel like that's a big loss for those communities when they lose that local connection, where it's written by people who are, you know, who live here and who are invested in it.
Nathan Marks is assuming the top job at the Minden City Herald in Sanilac County. Nathan, we're looking forward to hitting like on the Herald Facebook page pretty soon.
Thank you. I appreciate you having us, and we appreciate your support.
And we've also been talking with Nathan's grandfather, Paul Engel, who has been running the family business all these years. Paul, thank you so much for everything that you and your family have done.
Well, thank you. And just to say something about Nathan and Amber, that, you know, they're going to keep a lot of the old stuff, but they got a lot of good ideas for the, you know, the future too. And we're really proud of them.
And that's Stateside for today. I am Zoe Clark in for April Bear. Hey, we will catch you Friday. Have a great rest of your day.